He's a criminologist.
Oh, great.
Blog Talk Radio.
Well, you may throw your rock, hide your hand, working in the dark against your fellow man. But as sure as God made black and white, what's done in the dark will be brought to the light. You can run on for a long time, run on for a long time, run on for a long time. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Go tell that long-tongued liar. Go and tell that midnight rider. Tell the rambler, the gambler, the backbiter. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down.
Welcome to Walls in Our Minds. This is Terry Dodd. I'm here with my co-host Kurt McKenzie tonight. Red Beckman will be joining us shortly, and we've got Sheriff John Lopi on with us already, and Kurt will be giving him an introduction, but we always like to start out this show, Walls in Our Minds, with a prayer, so please pray with me. Almighty Father God, we just want to come to you tonight humbly and acknowledge that you are the one and only true God, and we're thankful that you have given us an opportunity to be reconciled with you through your Son, Yeshua, our Christ. And we just ask that your Spirit fill each and every one of us tonight, but especially the listeners, that they might hear and understand, and that everything that we can say tonight, Father, we pray that you would assist us and help us to make it so that it will glorify you. And we especially lift up those in Siskiyou County, California tonight, those the people that have put this good man, Sheriff Lopi, in office, and that he is serving and protecting, and we pray for your protection over that county. We especially pray that the people will know the truth, that they will know that you've given them the right to judge the law, and that you are the final arbiter on the law. And we lift up this man who is the highest county law official in Siskiyou County, and pray that his communication with those people will be rich and valuable to both of them, and that they will lift each other up and support one another in all of the efforts that are going on there today. And we pray that you would hold out those that are evil and are trying to do things that are wrong and unjust from them, and that you will show them the way to put you first and keep you at the top of the pecking order, and making certain that those that are coming into this area understand what they're up against. They're not just up against Sheriff Lopi, or they're not just up against the people, but they're up against you. And we just pray all of this in the name of Jesus, your Son. Amen.
Amen.
Well, Kurt, let the folks get to know Mr. Lopi.
Sure, I'd be happy to. It's actually my privilege to do so. Sheriff John Lopi has quite a long background. I'm going to abbreviate. He's ex-military guy. I know he was a Marine sergeant. For anybody Marines out there, you know how those guys are like. So I served in the Marines and in the military for a long time. I guess you were a career, and then 33 years in law enforcement. I first met Sheriff Lopi actually at the event. When I came up with the idea for a sheriff's panel to be at the October 22nd March and Defend Rural America, I talked to John, and John completely supported the idea, and he did a terrific job. He pulled together the panel, and ultimately we had 8 sheriffs that stood tall for the Constitution at that event, and I think that video of those 8 sheriffs plus Karen Bud Follin has gone nearly viral on YouTube. Remarkable individual. I can tell you this for a fact. He is very much loved by the people there in Siskiyou County. He is a constitutional sheriff, and he is standing up for the Constitution, the law, and to fulfill his oath of office. So it's my privilege to introduce you tonight, John. Probably the place I'd like to start is that, we've had a series of radio shows on this Defend Rural America campaign. I think we've already pretty much covered that we had the launch on October 22nd. Perhaps you can start by filling us in from your perspective what that launch has meant and what has happened subsequent to that launch.
Well, Kirk, it's a pleasure to be with you tonight. I think some of the most important aspects or outcomes of the Defend Rural America was really the sheriffs. Not only did eight sheriffs stand together on that stage, seven from California and one from Oregon, but I think it had an impact really not only in California and Oregon, but also all over the United States, because I belong to the California State Sheriffs Association as an example, partly as a result of the Defend Rural America event, and also, you know, some of the land use policy challenges that are being really encountered by almost all sheriffs that I know, especially, you know, rural sheriffs. We formed a land use policy committee, ad hoc committee, as an official ad hoc committee on the California State Sheriffs Association. And we're actually looking into issues that sheriffs are having all over California. And I can give you a few examples of that. But we are compelling federal and state agencies to properly coordinate and follow the law and deal with local officials and citizens before they come in and, you know, try to impose regulations or policies and programs that have an impact on our public health and safety, the welfare of our citizens, and also things like our economy. You know, our economy is adversely impacted up here by some of the policies that have been practiced through the years. I think another thing that came out of the Defend Rural America is I'm getting emails and phone calls from all over the United States. There's a lot of commonality between sheriffs and counties all over the United States, because almost everyone is overwhelmed by, you know, government regulation, and everybody's being challenged economically. You know, a lot of us are facing these challenges and threats to our traditions, the way that we make a living in our rural counties. And a lot of these public health and safety issues, you know, are definitely at play when you talk about, you know, tax revenues, and you talk about infringements on the Constitution. I think also, and I'll end it here, I think that a lot of sheriffs are starting to pay more attention to their oath of office and the fact that we all are sworn to uphold the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic. And I think that those great sheriffs that sit on that stage on October 22nd and you know, the attorney Karen Bud Fallon, I think we all stood for a common perspective, and that is, hey, look, you know, We're constitutional officers, and we're obligated not only to support and defend the Constitution of the United States, but also protect our citizens against, you know, possible infringements by, you know, some, you know, governmental agencies or others who would come into your county and just try to impose programs or policies or regulatory provisions that are just unreasonable or in some cases unlawful.
Let's go back to one area that I'd like you to talk a little bit more about, is the feedback that you've been getting from across the country. I know you shared with me a few of the stories, but in essence, from what I understand, people who had gotten pretty discouraged and didn't know where to go to, and all of a sudden, like a bright light was shining, they saw people who would stand up for the Constitution. Perhaps you can expand a little bit more on that.
Kirk, there are probably two areas that have been very evident to me in these messages I'm getting from these people all over the United States. One is people have had their faith in government restored to an extent. I've had people tell me that I am so disgruntled, I'm so disappointed, I'm so fearful of my government. And, you know, some of them are concerned about the federal government, some are concerned about state entities, and some are concerned about their local officials as well. And people have told me, hey, you know what, I see public officials like these sheriffs standing up for the Constitution, standing up for me, because I didn't think I had a voice, and they're standing up, and I've actually have hope that maybe things can become better, you know, in this great nation of ours. The other issue I think that's very important is that I have people who I had a guy write me a message that he had had some bad experiences with law enforcement agencies in the past, and he hated police officers of every stripe. He told me when he saw that video and he saw all those sheriffs standing up for the citizens of Siskiyou County and the citizens of Oregon, he had renewed faith and confidence in the law enforcement profession and felt differently, you know, from that moment on. And he looked up to us and respected us because of the stand that we are making. So I think the hope that we're restoring to a lot of people who have no hope or were so discouraged by some of the developments in their areas and in this country, they've got renewed hope. And we've got others who are looking at public officials once more with the confidence that, hey, maybe things can be done to help the, you know, the average citizen.
That certainly is a positive response, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Have you been contacted? I know we'll come back and talk about more of the local sheriffs, but have you been contacted by any of the sheriffs across the nation?
Yes, I've gotten messages from other sheriff's deputies. I've gotten the vast majority of messages, and I've gotten some bad messages too, where people really don't like what we're doing. But the vast majority of messages I get from both sheriffs and from members of other law enforcement agencies have been predominantly positive. I've got messages that say, hey, you know what? I wish my sheriff was doing what you're doing in Siskiyou County, or what Greg Hagwood is doing in Plumas County, or Dean Wilson's doing in Del Norte County. And I've also gotten messages from other law enforcement officials and employees all over the United States saying, hey, thank you for what you're doing. And most people are just very thankful that someone's willing to stand up and give citizens a voice and stick up for them, because there's a kind of a prevailing feeling that, you know, that they're not, that people aren't getting a lot of support from their government officials anymore.
It's so true, isn't it? We've kind of gotten used to taking so much, you know, having government sit on top of us rather than actually being there to help us, give us a helping hand. It's been a long time, hasn't it?
Yeah.
So it is a breath of fresh air. The you want to talk a little bit about the Bi-State Alliance?
Sure. Another thing, a byproduct of this, this is kind of an exponential growth enterprise, you know, this Defend Rural America, because we're gaining a lot of interest, not only from people within Siskiyou County, but other counties and also across the border. And we started a Bi-State Alliance where we're getting together some Siskiyou County residents and some officials like me, and collaborating with our partners in Oregon. And they've got some great sheriffs in Oregon. Gil Gilbertson, my friend from Josephine County. You know Glenn Palmer. He was at the Defend Rural America event from Grant County. And I've had some conversations with Mike Winters in Jackson County, and also the Klamath County Sheriff Tim Evinger. But what we're doing is we're getting some of these some citizens and even some of the officials from Oregon together, and we're getting together and we're identifying issues that impact us. For example, the Klamath Dam issue is a major challenge here, and it is a big issue for the Oregonians too, because three of the dams are in California, but one's in Oregon. So we're getting together and we're discussing these key issues, and we're mobilizing resources and people and trying to educate the public so that they can make an educated decision on these dam removal issues and challenge their officials to make good decisions.
And I think that is so important. You went up to Medford, wasn't it?
Yes, yeah, I did. I went to Medford to back up Gil Gilbertson. That's another thing, you know, the sheriffs, we've all offered, hey, you know, we're willing to travel and help you out, even if it's across state lines. And I think this collaboration and this communication is very important, because all the contiguous counties and obviously our border states, like here, you know, Oregon, I've got three Oregon counties bordering Siskiyou County, Josephine, Jackson, and Klamath counties. It's very important that we work together, because what really the decisions that are made here by us and you know, the and the government agencies here are going to impact them too. So, you know, it's a big issue, and we all have to share in the in identifying the solutions. And a lot of the information, and that's another thing. We've got to get the information out. We've got to educate the public. We've got to let them know what is really going on and what the impacts are going to be of some of these big decisions, like dam removal.
Yeah, I agree. We need, and people across all of rural America, you know, and in addition, all the people like myself in the urban parts of the country really have to, you know, we've taken things for granted for so long, I think, to a great extent. You know, who thinks about dams anymore, reservoirs? You know, they're there. They, you know, I know that every time I drive by a reservoir, I'm, you know, in California, we're used to drought, so, you know, you always check the water level, but you don't really think much about it beyond that. And all of a sudden you realize that our fundamental stuff that we just take for granted, our water, our energy, our minerals, our food, I mean, all these things are all of a sudden under assault. I mean, the impact of these things. And I think we've done a pretty good job on the show so far of developing some of those aspects to it. But you're absolutely correct. The critical nature is, you know, we're getting the message. We have the documentary video. We have now over 50 radio shows where we've taken various parts of the story, and we're going to have more. And really, it's got to be an effort now where people drive more people to come and get engaged in the story and see what's going on. I think Siskiyou County is ground zero not only for the government, I think it is for our side, because I think this is the place that, you know, we have sheriffs standing up, county commissioners standing up, the people are standing up, you know, and working together. We got 50 organizations in and around that area, plus up in Oregon, down to San Francisco Bay that are standing up with it. And, you know, we have a lot of highly intelligent PhDs and people that, you know that the science on this is false. I mean, there's so many resources that are really here to bear that I think this is the battleground as far as I'm concerned, and I think we need to bring as much resource to bear and the support as we can. It seems to me that winning this battle is kind of like a football game. First, you got to figure out who's going to get on the field, and then once you're on the field, who's going to come up to the line of scrimmage, and you look around and you say, okay, I got 8 sheriffs, okay, I got a commissioners, okay,
right.
I got the citizens are here with me too. You know, and eventually, you know, you get enough critical mass, then you have to say, okay, now what am I going to do? what's the plan?
Right. And, you know, this is this whole, I guess you could call it a battle or struggle that we're having against, you know, numerous, and I would say infringements or challenges to our future. It's kind of like a football game because, you know, we need the support of the people, just like a football stadium. You know, if the fans don't show up, then, you know, what kind of game you're going to have. And I think ultimately, you know, Siskiyou County is kind of a unique county, but it's not unlike many counties in California and other states. But we're a very large county. We're the fifth largest county geographically in California. We have 6,187 square miles, and about 65% of our land is public land. So anywhere where there are public lands, you know, there's a potential that you're going to be severely impacted, you know, by policies and programs. And we also, I think, what's unique about our county is the number of federal and state agencies that are involved in land use policy issues. And they're, you know, their land use policy issues. There are the dam removal issues. We have, you know, we have water issues are major, because what happened in our county is when the timber industry went in decline primarily because of the spotted owl over the last 30 years or so, you know, our economy has declined significantly to where we have many economically depressed areas, and we have one of the highest unemployment rates in the state. And I equate public safety issues to that decline because we have some of the highest drug abuse, alcohol abuse, domestic abuse, elder abuse, and child abuse rates in the state, and that's very problematic. And we also have a lot of problems with illicit drugs. And when you have those kind of challenges, which has largely been precipitated by these onerous regulatory practices and policies that have been imposed on your county, you got to sit up and take notice. And we also have other issues too, like on the Forest Service side, the Transportation Management Plan, which is denying some of our citizens access to public roads in mainly Forest Service areas. And we even have the forest management issues, which are rendering our forests potentially susceptible to catastrophic wildland fires. We have the jobs being taken away because you can't get a contract to go in there and thin out the dead and dying trees, and that also impacts the watershed. So, I mean, there's just a multitude of issues here.
And it's amazing, too, because, it touches upon jobs, it touches upon industries. It's like, you know, we're well aware that this country has pretty much exported a lot of its blue-collar jobs. It's exported one industry after another. I mean, name something that wasn't invented in the United States that's now been manufactured or copied or even being engineered in China or, India. We've exported industries. We're beginning to export in mass or white-collar jobs. And, you know, really, what's left? And rural America is the one thing that still is a strong base or has been for this country. I mean, the breadbasket of the world. And all of a sudden, we find that is under assault. You know, you can't be a strong nation if all you have is bankers printing money and government spending it.
Right, and Kirk, when you really think about it, what happened with the decline in the timber industry is now our number one industry in Siskiyou County is ranching and farming. Ranchers and farmers, traditionally, we have farmers and ranchers who have adjudicated water rights going back to the 19th century, and some of them even the mid-1800s. And, you know, what's more important than growing food in our country? And you see these things happening. Like, for example, I recently drove through the Central Valley of California, where in the San Joaquin Valley, thousands of acres of farmland was shut down because they wouldn't give water to the farmers because of the smelt fish. And up here, a similar phenomena is occurring, is we have ranchers and farmers who are the backbone of our county. And like I said, some of these ranches and farms go back many generations, and they're being challenged. Some of these governmental programs are potentially denying them or greatly diminishing their water. We for them to grow crops. We have a situation here where the Department of Water Resources at the state level came in, and because of some grandiose ideas, they're raising some of the water master fees for the ranchers and farmers 700%. Can you imagine if your local community assessed a 700% increase in your water bill? They're doing things that every time an ordinary citizen tries to make a living, whether it's in farming or ranching or it's in the timber industry or it's in mining or it's in recreation, it seems like every time they turn around, they're being deluged with some kind of regulatory provision which is inhibiting their capacity to make a living. And that's what I'm concerned about, because how can I sustain a public safety service at reliable or at sufficient levels to provide safety, security, and service to citizens I serve when my county is so destitute And then you have all these crime problems occur because of the depressed economic conditions. Another thing I'm concerned about is federal and state agencies in most cases are obligated to coordinate with local officials. Sometimes they don't follow their own plans. There are various land use management plans that the Bureau of Land Management has, U.S. Forest Service has, the Fish and Game is also subject to many of these provisions. Other organizations like the Bureau of Reclamation or Department of Water Resources or EPA or the National Marine Fisheries Service, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, before programs or regulatory provisions are imposed on local citizens, there's supposed to be consistency between the need to protect the environment and the need to take the human element or the human environment into account. And the federal or the state government is supposed to consider things like the economy. What's the economic impact? What's the impact of public health and safety? What's the impact on the traditions or the way of life of this particular locale? And oftentimes that's not being done, and to the detriment of our people. And isn't it sad, and I'll stop here in a minute, but isn't it sad that when I talk to citizens, they think that many of the, and I'm not saying all government officials, but some government officials care more about fish, frogs, birds, you know, and trees than they do about the human race. I mean, that's where we are right now.
Yeah, this is it's amazing. I think people have to kind of stand back and think, you know, we were the nation that led the world in everything, you know, manufacturing, production, education, everything, and look what's happened to us. The kindest thing you can say about Congress is they've been complete idiots in terms of, you know, managing our society. The more accurate thing you can say is they're driving us off a cliff, and it seems to be almost intentional because, you know, government, according to the Constitution, was there to help the people, and now it seems to be just on the other side of the deal. I know that you are going to be, you've joined, I know, the board with Sheriff Mack, and that there is an event coming up. Do you want to talk about that?
Well, Sheriff Mack is leading an effort for constitutional sheriffs, and there's a constitutional sheriff's conference that's going to be held the 27th through the 30th of January of 2012. And there's at least 200 sheriffs that are going to travel to Las Vegas for a couple days, and we're going to attend classes. And, you know, it's kind of an educational process where all of us are going to learn more about the Constitution. And, you know, the more you learn about the wisdom that our forefathers had when they form the Declaration of Independence and the U.S. Constitution and the Bill of Rights, you know, you think how brilliant these men were. And I think the more knowledge we have about the Constitution and about, you know, the laws that govern our nation, I think the more successful we are, you know, to push back on some of these, sometimes these foolish decisions that have an adverse impact, you know, on our counties. And you know, by no means are we saying that we defy all federal or state agencies. But what we do is what we want to hold our officials and challenge them to comply with the U.S. Constitution. We also want to defend our citizens who deserve our support. And I must say, one thing I was proud about those sheriffs, you know, one of the big messages of the Defend Rural America event was, hey, look, you know, the people don't serve us. We serve the people. And you look at the Constitution, the Constitution says we the people. It doesn't say we the government. So we as public officials, especially sheriffs, are obligated to stand up for the people and defend them. And defend the Constitution, because that's what, you know, it's right in our oath. And I think that this constitutional sheriff's movement, I think it's a positive thing, because we're going back to our constitutional roots, and we're standing for those values and those important constitutional guidelines and provisions that not only built our country and made it strong, but made it the most unique nation ever devised by human and divine intervention, in my opinion.
I'm with you 100% on that. I think that the, you know, it's worth fighting for, because I think that the history of mankind has been one of tyranny. I mean, essentially somebody has been dictating to everybody what to do, when to work, where to go, what they can make, how much money they have to give up, how much labor they have to perform for the master. That's been pretty much the history of mankind. The United States was the first nation to, I think, embody the idea in its totality from its foundation that, no, that this isn't how this works. The people are sovereign, and the government is to serve the people's interest, and it's to be a government of the people, by the people, and for the people. And how far we're fallen. I mean, I think that, you know, some people in this movement talk about a revolution. I say, no, the revolution's already happened. What we need is the restoration. Because we either restore that dream that our founding fathers have towards a world where people, you know, life means something, and that people are, have their own personal liberty, and they can make their own choices, and they don't have to be taxed to death. I mean, you know, that prosperity is okay, and or we're going to go backward into another totalitarian era, in my opinion, and that's unfortunately where this is going to go if we don't fight this back. The how are the people up in Siskiyou County doing?
Well, I think the people in Siskiyou County are, you know, doing well. You know, the good thing about Siskiyou County is a great county. We have fabulous citizens here, and we have a lot of courageous citizens. And you know, many of these citizens are standing up and defending our county and defending our ranchers and farmers and all those citizens that want to enjoy the freedoms that are really inherent in our Constitution and in our way of life. And I think right now, though, a lot of Siskiyou County citizens are also fearful to some degree, because the stakes are very high, like this the dam removal issue, for example. You know, I think almost 80% of the people of Siskiyou County voted to not remove the dams. They do not want those dams removed. And I think the percentage would actually have been higher had more of the people, we'd gotten out and maybe educated them on some of these, what we consider some of the deleterious or ill effects of the dam removal potentially on our county, on the economy, on our environment, on our public health and safety, and the welfare of our citizens. But you know, we're standing tall. We're fighting the fight. But I think all citizens also realize that, you know what, we're in the fight of our lives, because our county is not only ground zero for many of these governmental efforts, you know, to get control of our land and water, to take down four perfectly functioning dams down, you know, provide clean energy to in excess of 70,000 people. And people see this, and you know, a lot of questions come up, and you know, we're not getting all the answers, but you know, they're hanging tough, they're persevering, and they're the greatest citizens anywhere, and I think we're pretty optimistic. We're cautiously optimistic for the future.
Well, that sounds great.
John, can I jump in here for a second, Kirk? I want to tell you, we had Gail and Doug Jenner on last week on the show. And if they're any indication of the kind of people that you've got there in your county, talk about salt of the earth, backbone of America kind of folks that you'd love to have as a neighbor, they're it. And they were a pleasure to have on the program with us last week. And I feel the same way about yourself. We also had Bill Gilbertson and Glenn Palmer have both been here with us on Walls in Our Minds, and that was a great pleasure as well. I heard you make a comment a while ago about the some of these government officials caring more about the fish than they do the people. And I can't help but to jump in there and say I think the real battle is that they want to be God, and that they want to take God off of the top of the pecking order. And when they do that, it also removes the unalienable or inalienable rights of the individuals. That's how they turn things upside down in this pecking order. And Red Beckman, who has a live mic, he is with us now. And so is I will also advise you, Red, that Dr. Roger Roots is also have a live mic right now. And shortly, when we are through with the opening comments of Sheriff Lopey, Red, I'm going to want you to introduce Dr. Roots in a minute. So I'm just giving you a heads up to that. But this issue of the pecking order, Red has done some seminars on this, and I think that it's really important. You know, the sheriff position is the one highest law enforcement officer in the county that can help keep that pecking order the way it's supposed to be, and that is God, the people, the Constitution, and then the government. And we get caught up in this thinking that, you know, these guys really care about the fish. I don't think they care about the fish. They care about their own power and their own control over the people. They want to be able to steal the production of the people. They want to be able to steal our infrastructure. They want our water. They want our mineral rights. They basically want to be worshipped. And when you come to recognize that that kind of spiritual battle is going on, and that your job really is to keep God at the top of the pecking order, boy, that kind of changes the whole perspective of things. And maybe you can talk about that a little bit.
Well, first of all, I'm one of those strange citizens who believe that our Constitution, our nation, was inspired by God and biblical principles. And, you know, my perspective is, and I've told these federal, many of these federal and state agencies with whom we've interacted, hey, look, all of us in Siskiyou County, I don't know anybody who doesn't want to preserve the environment. But the fact of the matter is the environment for decades has been exalted above human beings. And it is almost like a religion to some of these activists. And I personally feel that we should follow the law. And when you, there's nothing wrong with protecting the fish. First of all, the ranchers and farmers, and many of the miners and recreationists in Siskiyou County are better conservationists than any of these, a lot of these government officials ever thought about being, because ranchers and farmers live off the land. They have created an environment that enhances the natural environment, that enhances habitat. And I don't care if you're talking about fish or fowl, or you're talking about deer or other animals. They are the greatest conservationists, and they perpetuate nature, in my opinion. Another thing that I'll add is the laws and common sense. And the thing is, it's almost as if common sense is going extinct in this great nation of ours. Yes, I believe that, yes, we have inalienable rights, and they're divine, and I don't have any reluctance whatsoever of putting my Creator as first, and then the people. And I'm one of those people that believe that God created the nature for man. He didn't create us to have to, you know, bow down or serve nature. And the thing is, nature was created for us, the fish and the birds and all that. Nature was created for the people. And what's happened is we have this imbalance. We have this terrible imbalance in this nation, this distorted imbalance, and it's been going on for decades, where we have special interest groups. And again, I love the environment. I want to preserve the environment. But for decades, at least in Siskiyou County, everything was oriented towards protecting the environment at the expense of the human environment or the people. And since when are the people going to finally get a fair break from their own government? And the government should hey, nothing wrong with protecting fish and wildlife, but not over the interests of people. And people, I believe, have an inherent right constitutionally, and even if you want to use that, you know, that term common sense, to make a living. Why shouldn't the people make a living? Does it make sense to go and cut down dead and dying and diseased trees out of the forest, give people jobs, and also remove the fuels so that we don't have the potential for these catastrophic wildland fires? You look at these forests, and the forests are dying. Plus, we hear this, oh, we don't have, you know, some of the conservation organizations will tell you, well, we need more water from the farmers and ranchers. Well, why don't you start cutting down some of these dead and dying trees, coordinate and synchronize with these other governmental agencies, and that's going to raise the water table, and you won't even have to get water from the ranchers and farmers. But see, in our country and in my county right now, there's very little semblance of common sense. There's very little deference to real science, which really substantiates what you're doing, and it's all for the environment. I just went to a Happy Camp coordination meeting, and that's an economically depressed area. At one time, they had several sawmills. Now they have none. And a lot of the people survive, you know, growing dope and selling drugs. Well, the coordination committee is negotiating with the U.S. Forest Service to try to create a situation where they can open a lumber mill and start harvesting the vast timber resources in the area. And we are told, well, it'll take you 4 or 5 years to get this approved, you know, so we can get the maximum yield sufficient to keep the lumber mill going. If you go biomass or you go pellets, it'll take less time. See, this is the bureaucracy, the red tape, and all the hurdles that are thrown in the way of these good people that are just trying to make a decent living. And everything is just, it's like it's upside down. And that's kind of the way I feel about that the people are being deprived of the right to make a living and to earn a living for their families like they did traditionally. And a lot of these governmental officials, all they care about is the fish and the birds and the trees and you're right, a lot of it's about controlling our resources and a lot of these environmental activists don't even live here. They don't even know the terrain. The Secretary Salazar, who's going to make the decision whether to initiate dam removal, has never even been here in Siskiyou County. He's never even been here, yet he's willing to make a decision that may implement or at least start the process to remove the dams. He flew over Siskiyou County once. Some of these people have no idea what's going on here. And I'll tell you, going in our communities, you see the devastation, the crime, and the poverty, then I think you'd probably have a different perspective on these things.
Kurt, I'll let you have it back.
Well, I think we've had actually a pretty good one at this. Before we go to the next guest, John, is there any closing comments or other further comments you want to make?
Well, I just want to thank you for the opportunity to be with you tonight, and I just wanted to thank all the great citizens out there that are listening. And I ask that everyone, become aware of what's going on in your communities, because our battle here is not just a battle for Siskiyou County or the survival of our kids or grandkids. It's also for the survival of America as we know it and the freedoms that have been really guaranteed by the Constitution, but are kind of eroding almost on a daily basis. So stand up, find out what's going on, get involved, and by all means, join some of these groups, get involved, make informed decisions, and by all means, vote. Get out there and vote, and get your family members and your friends and your neighbors to vote, because that's one of the big problems. People just aren't paying attention to what's going on, and before you know it, America, as they know it, is going to be lost.
All right, that's so true. Well, stay with us, because we want you to participate in the show before we're over here. Let's go ahead and turn it over then to Terry Vaughn for Dr. Roots.
Thank you.
I got to say, I'm really looking forward to the dialogue between Sheriff Lopi and Dr. Roots. That's going to be rich. Red, would you like to introduce our next guest?
Roger, I knew him before he had this PhD that he now is using.
And that doesn't stand for post hole digger, right?
Well, I've got a PhD, but it's post hole digger. And I've got calluses on my hands and all of that. But Roger is a rare bird. I'll never forget when I first met him. He had a friend, the two of them. They would be classed as terrorists under today's definitions. When they were going to school, and Roger has quite a background of confrontation with the establishment, the government agencies and such, and I'll let him explain how much of that he wants to explain. But he's just a rare young American. And, I really don't remember exactly when I first met him. I think it was in the 80s. I know it was in the 80s. And he was going to school in Billings, Montana. And him and his buddy, they were just turning everything upside down around that school and the political climate that we had there, and they were just young fellows. And Roger, of course, has gone to school. He's picked up his law degree, and he's not afraid. He wasn't afraid as a teenager as he hitchhiked back and forth across this country. He knows this country like very, very few young people, because I think he made about five hitchhiking trips, back and forth across this great nation back there when we still had, we had a better system back there than we have today. But he has seen it happen, and this gives me so much encouragement when I see people like this coming along, because I know that this freedom movement isn't going to die when I die. It's going to be there. It's in good hands, in very good hands. And I remark on a regular basis back in 1975 when I first decided I had to stand up and speak out. And, boy, I'll tell you, I was lonesome. There weren't too many out there that understood what I was saying or wanted to hear what I was saying. And today I'm not lonesome anymore. And Roger is one of the people at the head of that list that has made it so that I'm not lonesome anymore, and he's very effective, and he's going to be even more effective as we go along, as the people of this nation become aware of what has happened to their country. And I was just reminded here something one of the guests said. Reminded me of a radio talk show. Ray Bream was the top-rated late-night talk show host back in the 70s and 80s, a.k.a. ABC out of the Los Angeles area. Nationwide, he was
one of the best talk show hosts I've ever had anything to do with. And I don't remember exactly what our conversation was this one time. I was on his show a number of times, and I made the comment. I said, people just don't realize that Germany was the first nation to be conquered by the Nazis in World War II. This is something that we need to think about right here in this country. If we don't stop this freight train that's heading down the track in our direction, if we don't stop it, we're going to be in the same situation. We've got troops all over this planet, and we've got all kinds of things going on that our founders of this great nation must be spinning in their graves when they think, or if they know what we're doing, what is happening to us. And so Roger is, you know, he's going to be, he's going to go in the history books, I think, as a great American. He's equipped now with his education and everything to be very effective. And so I'm just thrilled to death to have him here on this program. And I'm having a hard time just waiting to hear what he's got to say, because what he says, what he's going to tell you, is very important, I'm sure. So, Roger, I sure am proud of you, and glad that you're here. Did we lose Terry again? Roger,
I'm here. I'm here. I thought Roger had a live mic. I hope he does. Roger, are you there? Well, the problem is I think Kate stepped away for a minute, and I'm hoping that he didn't drop, and now we don't have somebody to give him another live mic. So, wow, I tell you what, Red, why don't you speak for a minute, and I'll text Kate and make sure that she knows he's dropped, so she may have to give him a live mic again.
Yeah, well, you know, it is such an exciting thing for me to hear these sheriffs and such, you know, speaking out and recognizing what that oath of office meant. We've got a lot of people out there that have no clue. They take that oath of office and they haven't even read the Constitution, other than probably in the eighth grade in grade school or something like that. Somehow or other, we've got to get across to these people the importance of that oath and what it means, the value of that oath. So, and of course, you know, we have made some things happen in this country inadvertently. We didn't know we were doing it, I guess. We just didn't know what we were doing. But we did it somehow. And what I'm talking about, of course, is the fact that, well, 25, 30 years ago, people would ask me, well, when are we going to get this thing turned around? When is this nation going to kind of come alive and make the corrections that we have to make? And I had a standard answer. I said, we've got to have an economic meltdown across the United States. And if that happens, then the people will start to wake up. Their hearing becomes much better. when we have an economic meltdown, as we have experienced here in the last couple of years here in America. And their hearing is better, they're thinking better, and we're there. It's here right now. And people are paying attention. And, of course, we need the leadership. The sheriff, the county sheriff, he's going to have a lot of responsibility here in the future to try to see to it that the people in this county become better informed. And it's going to happen. I can see it happening. And so I'm just real pleased with what's happening. Have we found Roger yet? Do we have him on? Or? Well, we don't even have Terry right now.
Yeah, I'm here. I muted because I was making calls and stuff. So still trying to track down Kate so that we can get him back on. I'm sure he's probably dropped and has tried to call back in, and there's nobody on the switchboard. So
There's one thing that I've thought of here in this last couple of 3 weeks. The programs we've had, they've been very fruitful as far as I'm concerned. But we want to keep in mind the fact that there are some public servants out there that realize the danger that we're in this country. And we don't want to badmouth everybody that is a public servant. And I say that because I have a younger brother who spent his life working for the Forest Service. And he's a graduate, University of Montana Forestry School graduate, and all of that. And
Red.
Hello.
Dr. Roots is with us now, Red.
Okay, I'll save the story and get it across, but there's public servants out there that don't go along with all this stuff, and we need to find out who they are and cooperate with them every time we have a chance. And then, Roger, did you hear my introduction?
I heard the entire thing, Red. Great. I'm
proud of you.
I'm blushing red. Yeah, thank you very much. I just
Roger,
hope I can live up to everything you said.
I don't want to tie up your time. I just want to let you launch off and tell us about grand juries and give us a little bit of history on yourself, and then we'll get you talking with Sheriff Lopi, who's online with us.
Well, all right. Yes, thank you very much, and thank all the listeners, and especially to Red Beckman. My name is Roger Roots. I'm originally from the state of Montana, and as Red pointed out, I have I began my adult career in sort of an odd fashion. I was hitchhiked across the country several times, and I was sort of a troublemaker and a drifter, and had lots of run-ins with the authorities over the years. I was locked up several times, and to make a long story short, when I probably turned, I don't know, 25 or so, I was more or less free. They finally released me, and I started, I guess, my education at that time. I was actually a high school dropout at the time, but started going to Eastern Montana College there in Billings. It's now called Montana State University Billings. I met up with Red Beckman and many other just great people at that time. Anyway, to make a long story short, I found I was doing fairly well in school, and I got accepted into a law school on the East Coast, Roger Williams University School of Law in the state of Rhode Island. And, it was an uphill battle because of my, I had a criminal record and lots of these kinds of issues. Took me a long time after I graduated from law school, and actually I had passed the Rhode Island State Bar exam, but it still took me 4 years after that to get my law license there. And I went on, while I was sort of waiting for things, I also did obtain a PhD at University of Nevada, Las Vegas, in sociology. So I was actually in, even though I was a high school dropout, I think I totaled up my post-secondary education, my higher education. I spent more, I've actually had more years of schooling in higher education than in grade school and high school. Anyway, to make a long story short, I could go on and on, but I have studied grand jury history, constitutional history relating to the grand jury clause of the Fifth Amendment quite extensively. And I think I could really, you know, probably I could go on at length on that topic. I really enjoy reading old cases about grand jury law, and I don't know what exactly where you wanted to go into, you know, what areas you wanted to explore. But basically, a lot of people don't really, you know, it's funny, even lawyers don't know very much about grand juries. They don't know much about grand jury law or the history of it. I know that you guys do. Red Beckman certainly knows a great deal about it. A lot of Americans do not even know that the common law that we base our constitutional background on here in the United States, you know, obviously it came from England, and grand juries were part of the executive branch, basically. Now, I should say that some scholars paint them as, well, a separate fourth, sort of a fourth branch. Some people place the grand jury in the judiciary branch. Anyway, it doesn't really matter, but basically, no prosecutor could pursue an indictment or a criminal accusation against anyone without first getting the approval of a grand jury, which is, you know, usually 23 Americans, common citizens, not you know, no government authorities whatsoever, the common citizens. And by the way, the numbers sometimes vary depending on the jurisdiction and the time period, the numbers of people on the grand jury, but there had to have been this approval of this common citizenry before the government could pursue any prosecution. So the grand jury acted as both a sword and a shield. It protected the, it protected people from the government, and it, of course, was acted as a sword. It initiated criminal investigations, and only after it handed off a criminal investigation to a government authority, such as a district attorney or something, could a criminal accusation begin. What's really, I think, disturbing and unfortunate is that we have lost so much of this understanding of the true purposes of grand juries in our constitutional makeup.
Roger, this is Kirk. Well, maybe I'll jump in with a question, because I'd like to actually start from A to Z. So tell us, the grand jury is actually specified in the Constitution, correct?
Yes, it's in the, there's something called the Fifth Amendment Grand Jury Clause. Says that no infamous crime can be, or criminal prosecution can be begun without first getting a grand jury indictment or presentment. And what's funny about the word presentment is we've lost, at the federal level in America, we've lost all, shall we say, the word presentment has no application in modern federal law, because the drafters of the federal rules of criminal procedure deliberately did away with the ability of a grand jury to publicize a presentment and make it public. In other words, they did away with the power of a grand jury to issue a report that would be public, and which was, let's just say, without necessarily the approval of a prosecutor. And it's really unfortunate, because the presentment power of the grand jury is as important as any other thing that a grand jury does. A grand jury properly is supposed to conduct investigations over a wide variety of things, almost, you know, and by the way, the original design and intention is that the grand jury investigate government, you know, foremost, as its most important target of investigation and inquiry, and we've completely lost touch with that.
Now, I read your paper, and it'll be up on the Defend Rural America website, but basically, as I understand it, let's explore this original intent a little bit. The grand jury was there not only to indict, like you say, but also to investigate government, and it was free to do this without having the king's men, without having the government people in the room. In other words, the common citizens were to conduct the investigation themselves. Is that correct?
Absolutely. All through, let's just say, by the way, the grand jury is a very old institution. Let's say it began, you know, way back, you know, Magna Carta, 1215, maybe I think before then, actually. All through the period of where the common law was developing in England, and of course it came over the Atlantic Ocean to the colonies, and all through the 19th century, it was virtually unheard of for a government prosecutor to be in the presence of a grand jury. Maybe I misspoke. Around about 1850, it started to develop where the law became a little bit more complicated, and as the 1800s sort of went along, the law became more complicated. Grand jurors, who of course were lay citizens, you know, sometimes they had questions about the law or about the complexity of the law, and so they would ask. Sometimes they would ask a lawyer, a district attorney, to come in and answer a few questions. And over time, it developed that the district attorney would write documents up and present them to, you know, hand them off to the grand jury. And over time, it developed that the district attorneys would sort of then initiate what the grand jury would focus on, which was really unfortunate, because by the time American history reached about, you know, let's say the year 1900 or so, in most jurisdictions, it had changed so that, you know, it was sort of normal for the prosecutor to be right there in the midst of the grand jury, and it's been that way for the last century, really. It really turns the entire process of the grand jury on its head, because it really makes it almost impossible, very, very difficult, for a grand jury to investigate the prosecutor, to investigate the government. After all, if the prosecutor is right there with the grand jurors in the grand juror investigation, if the prosecutor is there asking all the questions of the witnesses, it's very difficult for the grand jury to, accuse the prosecutor of any wrongdoing.
Let's go back and let's keep focused on the original intent, and I'm going to kind of throw in what little I know, Roger, so you correct me. But so essentially it's a constitutional body. It's built in as part of the mechanism of the balance of powers. The people are to have a direct hand in this process that would lead up to any kind of a prosecution of somebody on, I think it was the larger offenses, I forget the exact terminology in the Constitution. The people themselves, the citizens that sat on this jury, were to conduct the investigation themselves, and the king's men, the president, the government people were not there unless they were invited to be there, and the grand jury had the power to choose what it wanted to pursue. Is that correct?
Yes, absolutely. And they had the power to, one of the most important powers they had was their power of secrecy. And they had the power to work in secret, which was a protection for them. And what has happened over time, at least in the last 100 years, is it's been sort of turned on its head. It's been sort of perverted such that now with the government prosecutor in the midst of grand jury proceedings, they've sort of using the secrecy against the grand jury, where they constantly are threatening grand jurors. If you publicize anything that happens in this proceeding, you know, you can be criminally prosecuted, and you're looking at 5 years in federal prison, you know, if you violate your code of secrecy. Well, that isn't the original purpose of secrecy. The original reason and purpose for grand jury secrecy was to protect the grand jurors from government, not so that the government could use it as a weapon against the grand jurors. Again, it's been completely turned on its head.
So So the idea was they would be able to conduct these investigations in secret so they wouldn't be subject to government retribution or whatever, and they had the power to subpoena?
Oh, yes, exactly.
And any other powers they had? In the original?
Well, I mean, they had the power to subpoena witnesses, subpoena documents. And by the way, we don't even think about this today, but they had the power to go out into the community and investigate things at the scene. You know, if a complainant, let's say a common person, came forward to a grand jury or a grand juror and said, "Hey, I'll key you in that the mayor is taking bribes," or you know, any scenario like this, the grand jurors could, you know, they could go out into the community, they could go out to the all over town. They could ask questions of people. They really were sort of a citizens' investigatory body.
And so, essentially, if they conducted these investigations, they could initiate their own investigation on either their own, you know, one of them had concerns, or somebody had brought a concern to them, or a DA could bring a concern, or a judge, whoever it could be. It was the grand jury that decided what they wanted to pursue and how they're going to pursue it.
Yeah, that's true. And, of course, today, in jurisdictions that have grand juries, and keep in mind, not all of them do, but it's, today it's most common for the prosecutor to initiate everything. In other words, the prosecutor goes before the grand jury. What happens is the grand jury gets sworn in by a judge, and they're told that they have to, you know, follow the Constitution and et cetera. Often what's most important is what they're not told. But anyway, they're immediately introduced to the prosecutor, and the prosecutor then begins telling the grand jury what the grand jury is going to be considering. And, you know, again, this has turned the entire common law and constitutional intent on its head. Today, the prosecutor calls the witnesses, writes the subpoenas, brings the witnesses in, and then hands the grand jurors his proposed indictment and says, "Well, I want you to vote on indicting this whatever, coke dealer, whatever it is, alleged coke, whatever, drugs, guns, you name it." Usually victimless, I shouldn't say usually, often victimless offenses, hands them the document and then says, "Go back into your chamber, your grand jury deliberation room, whatever that happens to be, and vote on whether or not you approve the indictment that I, the prosecutor, have drafted up." And, of course, we know from the data that we have, the statistics that have been released in recent years, grand juries overwhelmingly vote in accordance with the wishes of the government prosecutors today. And that was not true in the past as much.
Now, based upon your studies, has there been any constitutional amendment to change the original intent of the grand jury?
No, absolutely not. And that's why what the problem is that we have these federal rules of criminal procedure, actually Rule 5 and Rule 6 and Rule 7, of the Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure, Rule 6 and 7 primarily, which basically have codified the opposite of what the grand jury is supposed to do. In other words, these rules, Rule 6 and 7 of the Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure, basically state that prosecutors shall always be allowed to be among the grand jury except in their deliberations, and they say that all notes and stenographic recordings, any all of the documents that are compiled in any grand jury investigation shall be kept in the custody of the government prosecutor. Again, that is not the way it was originally intended. And so we have that the Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure, which in my opinion virtually overturn the Fifth Amendment grand jury clause. And they act almost as an amendment, although they certainly don't have the constitutional authority to do so.
So where do you think, where do we stand today? Do we have, you know, do the grand juries have any of the original powers left? I mean, do you feel that they can reinvoke the powers under the Constitution, or do you think these are lost?
What's funny is, you know, I wrote an article that was published in the Richmond Journal of, I think it was called the Richmond Journal of Law and Policy, where I just say it's a national disgrace, and it really is. And almost every scholar of constitutional law, almost every commentator, almost every observer who looks into the current state of grand jury practice comes away with the conclusion that the entire thing is a national disgrace, and it really is. And keep in mind, because a lot of listeners probably are not aware of this, many states do not have provisions in their state constitutions for the requirement of a grand jury process to initiate all felony prosecutions. Most of the early states, the eastern states, the original colonies, do have grand jury requirements because they are more, you know, they had more of a common law connection. But the Fifth Amendment grand jury clause, which is in the federal constitution, is one of the few provisions of the Bill of Rights that has never been imposed or what they call incorporated to the state court practice by the U.S. Supreme Court. So we have a lot of the western states. Montana is one of them, my home state, and a lot of the other western states do not have very good provisions at all in their state constitutions for grand jury practice at all. And a lot of the western states initiate criminal prosecutions not by grand jury but by other mechanisms such as so-called preliminary hearings, which are just in front of a judge.
Let's assume we have a situation where we have a constitutional sheriff and we have a constitutional district attorney. With their support, could a grand jury be convened and operate according to its constitutional purpose?
Well, in my opinion, it's completely lawful for any court, any judge, or I should say a court of general jurisdiction at least, to swear in a grand jury at any time. And by the way, there are such things as special grand juries where, and there have been many examples over time, of where a judge decides to call forth a grand jury and swears them in and says, you know, that I want you to investigate such and such phenomenon. By the way, a lot of the corruption in New York City, Boss Tweed, some of you might have heard of Boss Tweed. At one time in the early, I believe the early 1900s, there was so much corruption in New York City that a special grand jury actually investigated all of it and took down many government officials, really cleaned up the city. So it can happen, and it certainly the prosecutor should not be involved to the extent that they are, at least in federal grand jury practice today, should not be involved to that extent. Now, how do we get things corrected and returned and restored to the way it's supposed to be? Well, hey, it's an uphill battle. We've got to do a lot of education. Unfortunately,
let's take the situation, Roger, of Siskiyou County. I want to keep this thing not, you know, kind of in the ether out there. Let's say, can we apply this in Siskiyou County, where we have constitutional people, we have constitutional sheriff, we have a constitutional district attorney, we have people standing up, and we have federal agents that are acting in a pretty egregious manner and doing things that we think are they don't have the authority or the power to do, and they're doing them illegally. Is a grand jury a method for redressing these grievances, so to speak?
Well, my answer is that it certainly is at the common law, and there's certainly no doubt about that fact. You know, a group of citizens could get together and initiate, let's just say, form a grand jury. They should probably do it through the court, the court machinery of the locality. Of course, there are many, many problems with this, and let me just say what really happens in practice. Red can tell you what really happens. I mean, there have been many cases where groups of people, you know, who study common law things, and, you know, they, you know, the sovereign citizen kind of communities and these kinds of things, often what happens, they'll try to form a grand jury in accordance with the way that it's supposed to work, and what happens is they find that they get criminally charged. It's happened in Alaska very recently, just last year, or last summer, I believe, where the feds come in and start prosecuting them for things like, you know, intimidating government officials and that kind of thing, threatening government officials. So, you know, just keep in mind, my recommendation is to tread very carefully on these things.
Well, Roger, you know, the saying is if something doesn't comply with the Constitution, it's not really law.
So that, of course, is true.
The question is, how do we put these grand juries back on track? And what specifically can a sheriff do that can influence that within his county?
Well, keep in mind, a sheriff can be a complainant, just like any citizen. The sheriff can bring a complaint to a grand jury and can initiate an investigation. You know, and by the way, a sheriff can help assist with an investigation, you know, summoning witnesses, suggesting witnesses, these kinds of things. Keep in mind that what I said before also applies in a different way to trying to criminally prosecute federal officials at the state level. And I'll just say that there are a lot of obstacles and hurdles that have been put up by the federal courts to protect federal officials from state proceedings. And of course, so many of us are aware of those kinds of things. What will happen, there's a doctrine that's developed in some U.S. Supreme Court cases where it is said that any federal official who finds himself being prosecuted by state authorities can immediately have the case removed to federal court. And in federal court, he will find, of course, a much more, let's just say, usually a more favorable climate. And often you'll see where a state prosecutor wants some federal agents prosecuted. Oh, it gets removed to federal court, and then it gets dismissed or sort of just, you know, sloughed off to the side or something. So there are a lot of hurdles that have been erected.
Well, you once wrote a paper that was titled, as I recall, "If It's Not a Runaway Grand Jury, It's Not a Real Grand Jury."
Yes.
So if these people that are sitting on these grand juries are truly sovereign, they really do have the final say on the law. They don't have to listen to, you know, what the instructions from that judge. They don't have to let the prosecuting attorney lead them around by the nose. They can investigate anything they want to. They have complete subpoena power. Anything that's going on within their jurisdiction, they have a right to launch out on their own. That's what a runaway grand jury is called. You know, why don't we educate the people that they have that right? And you know, especially a sheriff. I mean, we've got situations where some of these jury foremen have been on the juries for over 20 years illegally within their states. And isn't it also the job of a sheriff as a law enforcement officer to go out there and be sure that those grand juries are being conducted in a constitutional and lawful manner? I mean, they can go and check that out. That's one of the things that they should be doing as a sheriff, is making certain that grand jury is being assembled according to the law, and that they understand what their duties and rights as a juror are. Is that not something that a sheriff could also interact with them?
Well, I agree, absolutely. One problem is that the grand jurors themselves are in the dark about their true powers and about their actual purpose. I mean, I know a guy who was in a state grand jury in a state on the East Coast who said that he was called to serve on a grand jury, and he was serving with his fellow state grand jurors, and he was in the elevator going up to some grand jury proceedings of some kind, and he was chit-chatting with his fellow grand jurors one day, and he said that one of them said something to the effect that we are supposed to work for the prosecutor, something like that. And this gentleman, who happens to be sort of a libertarian, had some knowledge, said, no, that's actually not true. It's the very opposite. The prosecutor is our servant. We are over the prosecutor. The whole purpose of the grand jury is to act as a check on the prosecutor. But that's just one example. The public and the grand jurors themselves, unfortunately, are so undereducated on this subject. And so, yeah, I actually think the sheriffs and really all of us have a duty to try to, you know, get the word out. When you serve on a grand jury, it is your duty to act as a check on the prosecutor. You don't work for the prosecutor, and you don't work for the judge. It's your duty to work on as a check and really a protector of your fellow Americans, or really a protector of anyone from government. And we just, you know, there's just such a level of ignorance and apathy, unfortunately.
Well, the question is, if you were a sheriff, knowing what you know about grand juries, how would you interact with them?
Well, I like what you just said about the fact that the sheriff maybe should take on the role of trying to educate the grand jurors about their true duties and their true historic intent and the purpose behind the whole institution. Again, I need to caution here because, keep in mind, sheriffs are generally at the state level, the local level, really the county level. They are county officials under state law generally, and you know often, at least in the western states, grand juries really. And I'm most familiar with in Montana, where the grand juries that we have in Montana are federal grand juries. So it's a little bit, let's just say, awkward, where a county sheriff would be having a lot of exchanges with federal grand juries. It's a little bit, it becomes a little awkward because, again, you're talking about two different jurisdictions. Now, keep in mind, many states do have grand juries as well. And where that occurs, it probably is the duty and probably is the proper role of the sheriff to assist in the educating grand jurors about their lawful function and their legitimate powers.
Well, how can a sheriff then also maximize their authority and their effectiveness within their county to be a constitutional sheriff? How can they maximize that power by using the grand jury as a tool?
Well, keep in mind that a sheriff can be a complainant just as any citizen can. Any citizen should be able to approach a grand jury or a grand juror, even a single grand juror, and say, hey, are you on that grand jury? Are you the truth is that the courthouse, the local courthouse, should, let's just say, give the public if not the address of the grand jury foreman, at least an avenue for any common citizen to approach the grand jury foreman to send a letter saying, hey, I know of some stuff you guys should look into, and to approach the grand jury and say, hey, I'd like to be a witness and to inform the grand jury of some things that are going on, whatever it happens to be. And certainly a sheriff can perform that function as well as any citizen. And like I said, the grand jury is both the sword and the shield. It is the sword when it initiates a prosecution. And that, you know, that, by the way, the grand jury was put there, this requirement of this cumbersome group of 23 citizens. It's a cumbersome institution. And it is the sword of prosecution, but it's cumbersome and it's a little bit inefficient in a way, deliberately by constitutional design. That is the constitutional design, is that it be a little bit cumbersome, a little bit inefficient to initiate prosecutions. Okay, but the grand jury is not just a sword, it is a shield as well, a sword and a shield. It is a protector of their fellow citizens. It is a protector of the community. And a sheriff can, of course, assist in that role as well. Let me think of a way that might happen. Well, let's think of some examples. I don't know if anyone has any examples of such a thing.
Well, let's get Sheriff Lopey back in this conversation. John, do you have any specific questions about the grand jury?
Well, I'll make the comment that I think the grand jury is a great tool. We have a grand jury in Siskiyou County, and the grand jury is often used by the prosecutor, to pursue. To get an indictment for criminal acts. I think the sheriff, I'm involved because one of the functions of the grand jury is to do an annual inspection of our jail, and they look into how some government entities are functioning. As far as, federal and state organizations that we have to interact with, I think that federal and state organizations are not only accountable to bodies like the grand jury, but also to, we have state laws and in my opinion, no one's immune from the law. I mean, a federal authority or a state authority that comes into our county still has to, in my opinion, have the authority to enforce the law or initiate rules and regulations that they're trying to enforce. They're still accountable to bodies like the grand jury, and the DA can, bypass the grand jury. They could go right to the courts. They can file a criminal complaint, and someone can actually, be prosecuted in court, or the DA can get an indictment through the grand jury. And we've actually had allegations here where, for example, and these are allegations that, some state authorities are sometimes a little overzealous and may use the color of authority and intimidation to, achieve their objectives or goals. And those are the kind of things where the sheriff can stand in. I can interact with the prosecutor, with our district attorney, to determine if there are actually any state statutes that have been violated. Sometimes the federal and state agencies actually violate their own rules and plans and regulations, like some of these land use management plans that they've developed, or things like the National Environmental Policy Act, or CEQA, which is a comparable California provision. So, I mean, there are a lot of ways the sheriffs can, intervene. And like the good doctor said, we can file a complaint. We can use the jury. We can the grand jury. We can use the prosecutor. And even though a prosecution of a federal or state, law enforcement official or official for that matter, serving in another capacity might be difficult because some of these provisions of federal law, it can still be done. And in my opinion, just everybody's accountable, not only to the Constitution, but also to the laws, both federal, state, and even local.
So do you think, for example, it would be within, say, a civil grand jury or grand jury constituted by the county to look into the road closures and determine if there's legal authority to do that?
Yes, I think there's applicability there because what I've argued with the federal authorities is, I kind of agree with Red that, our problems are not really with the local, sometimes they are, but the local, federal, and state officials are not the ones that generally create these huge problems for us. It's the managers or the bureaucrats in Sacramento at the state level or in Washington, D.C. For example, when you talk about U.S. Forest Service, you got it's a Department of Agriculture, and they and a lot of these are regional, but many of them are national programs that they try to force on local jurisdictions, like the Transportation Management Plan. What I've argued is the Transportation Management Plan inhibits and adversely impacts public health and safety and the welfare of our citizens, and infringes upon the rights endowed by the Constitution, because one is I've got to have access to roads. I've got to, if a law enforcement unit responds to an emergency like a serious felony in U.S. Forest Service or public lands, I've got to have access to the roads. The fire has to have access to the roads. Emergency medical services have to have access to the roads. I've had issues where we had problems getting access to some areas during search and rescue operations, and the sheriff in this county presides over search and rescue operations. We have drug cartels, from Mexico operating in our public lands in Siskiyou County. So I basically advise the Forest Service. I feel as a sheriff, I have the authority to open any road, public road in Siskiyou County. And I think you're obligated. You didn't coordinate with me. You didn't come to me and tell me, oh, we're going to close these roads down. And I recently asked them to do two things. One is give me a list of all roads that you plan to close. And secondarily, I want a map that includes both the current and decommissioned roads. Now, I was recently, and I recently was advised by the Forest Service, you're not getting the map with the decommissioned roads. And I said, well, that's a public safety hazard, because people are going to have inaccurate maps, and they can be more susceptible to getting lost or taking the wrong route. And they said, well, and what I was told was the legal advisors at the national level made that decision. Well, now I've got to send a letter to the Department of Agriculture appealing that and complain about that, because a lot of these decisions for these big programs can't be settled at the local level. It has to go to the higher levels.
Well, it seems to me, so first off, so if the listeners understand partly what's going on here, the federal agents are, without any authority whatsoever, shutting off the national forest. I mean, they're literally taking the roads and destroying the first 50 or 100 yards of them, putting a gate across them. Nobody can go in. And then furthermore, they're removing them from the maps, so people don't even know that the roads even exist. And so this is part of the deal. And then the travel plan, I assume, is that the federal government wants you, as a local sheriff, they want to dictate to you to enforce their closures and make it unlawful for the public to enter public property.
That's about the size of it, yeah.
That's about the size of it. Yeah. And I think if the battleground is always where we believe that we have to go to Washington, D.C. to fight the battle, I think we're going to lose. I think you have individuals, and individuals are accountable for their actions and whether they're getting direction from above or not. It's been established pretty much in law that you cannot, as an individual, violate the law just because, you're told that's what to do.
Right, and you're right. I agree with you that we are still waging the local battle. And quite frankly, if I want a road open and there's a gate and I don't have a key, I'll cut the lock and open that road up. And yes, we're dealing with that at the local level. But some things like the maps, they're not going to publish the maps at the local level. So we got to go to higher authority to see, and really it's putting them on notice more than anything else. I don't expect them to do a turnaround on this, but I'm putting the higher level officials who are making these decisions and authorizing these infringements on notice that, one, I believe it's unlawful. I don't think they have the authority to do it, and I believe that there are public safety and health and welfare issues involved. And then we deal with the locals. And that, quite frankly, I want a road open. I feel comfortable about opening the road. I have been on search and rescue missions where we had someone that is in dire straits on Mount Shasta, and that's Mount Shasta is over 14,000 feet high. And I've been told, we can't have the helicopter land until we get permission from the supervisor of the forest.
Yeah.
I said, look, we will follow protocol and we'll ask for permission. But as the ranking person in charge of the search and rescue, I embrace my brethren in the Forest Service. But if I got to rescue somebody, the helicopter's going up there. And
yeah.
So, I mean, there are things that we do here, like, that to I mean, we're going to make it happen at the local level. We're going to operate and make decisions in the best interests of the citizens we serve. I guarantee you that.
Well, that's fantastic. Do you think that a grand jury would be able to actually subpoena federal agents and question them about the policies and where they're deriving their authority to do what they're doing, and question, for example, a NOAA agent who behaves the way he did and acts without coordination? I mean, do you think they have the ability to do that, and do you think it would be constructive if they did?
Yes, yes. Now, Dr. Roots is an authority on this, and he knows more about it than I do. But I'll give you a recent example, though, that illustrates what his concern is. We had a miner who had some of his property confiscated by a Forest Service official. He took them to civil court to get damages because, you know, he took his property away. I'm working with the Forest Service to try to resolve the issue because I think they kind of went overboard in dealing with this individual. But what they did was, at the last minute, they went into our local court and had the case transferred to the federal court. But it went so that's some of the things that illustrates Dr. Root's concerns. Yes, they will do things like that. But
isn't it up to the judge's discretion to keep it local?
Yes, but the judge granted the motion made by the federal authorities. By the U.S. attorney,
if I could just add, yeah, it's pretty much automatic. There is a doctrine that has been developed, and it's been enshrined by the U.S. Supreme Court, that when state prosecutors go after a federal official, the federal official has the right to have the entire case removed to federal court at any time. And it's funny, you know, it's sort of developed in a case years ago, about probably over 100 years ago, involving a U.S. Supreme Court justice named Stephen J. Field. Stephen J. Field, a sitting member of the U.S. Supreme Court, it's a funny story, but he had been on a train in California, and one of his ancient rivals, who had been a state of California Supreme Court justice. Anyway, it was a very interesting, fascinating story. But they had a lot of bad blood between them, and it looked like they were going to have either a fist fight or maybe a shootout between them. I mean, I'm not making this up. This is true history. And U.S. Supreme Court Justice Stephen Field's bodyguard opened fire and I believe shot and killed this other former judge of the California State Supreme Court. My memory about these, the precision of these details is a little imprecise, but that case went up to the what happened is the state of California prosecutors did prosecute Stephen J. Field, the U.S. Supreme Court justice's bodyguard, for murder, and I believe even the U.S. Supreme Court Justice Field was arrested and actually taken to jail in handcuffs in California. And we're talking in the year like 1890 or 1885 or something. And it basically, the case worked its way up to the U.S. Supreme Court. U.S. Supreme Court came out with this doctrine that is still the law today, that whenever state prosecutors go after a federal agent or official of any kind, that it can always be removed to federal court. And let's just face it, where the environment is a little bit more friendly to the federal officials. And what happened in that case, by the way, was that the federal bodyguard of U.S. Supreme Court Justice Field basically got off. He ended up having the murder case, I believe, either overturned or dismissed. I'm not completely sure. But, yeah, that doctrine, as the sheriff just said, has continued down through time. And there have been many cases. The Randy Weaver incident had a case where a U.S. federal FBI, I believe a sniper, was prosecuted for either murder or manslaughter in the state of Idaho by state of Idaho prosecutors. And what happened there, same exact thing. They removed the case to federal court, and it was either dismissed or it was sort of, it basically ended up, let's just say, more in the favor of the federal official. So that's a doctrine, and it's a hurdle that that you have to recognize. And it probably is not going to be overturned anytime soon.
In California, it's my understanding that there's two different kinds of grand juries. I want to get in that in just a second, but I'm also interested because of the concept that I understand about a runaway grand jury. That's an indicting grand jury that's been called in California. I believe the Superior Court is responsible for calling those grand juries on at a county level. Once they've been convened, once they've been assembled, nobody that I understand, according to constitutional law, has the right to dictate to them what they can or cannot investigate. So I'm a little puzzled how a grand jury might be investigating something and somebody can come in. Now, I can understand once charges have been brought in a state court, let's say, how there may be some agreement by the state to allow for things to be pulled over into the federal level. But it seems like there should be autonomy, there should be sovereignty at the state level that, you know, that hasn't, if it hasn't been expressly constitutionally delegated to the feds, I don't see how that can happen even in a state court unless the state allows it to happen. But in
right.
a grand jury situation, there shouldn't be anybody that could come back in there and dictate to them what they can or cannot investigate. Am I wrong about this?
Well, I think, one thing about California grand juries, generally the county level grand juries focus on oversight of governmental institutions at the, you know, the county level or lower. So I believe that there's some applicability. And one thing that we, like recently, what I did with NOAA, when they came
John,
over to my, yes.
Did I lose contact here?
I'm still here. If I would address that real quick, I'll just say you're absolutely right. That is a real conundrum. In fact, I've read, you know, there are U.S. Supreme Court opinions and decisions that have all kinds of language in them that say things like, you know, the grand jury has the right and the power to investigate anything. And, I believe that those kinds of statements have been written by the U.S. Supreme Court in some cases, you know, as recently as maybe 50 years ago, maybe even more recently than that. But you're right. You raise a very good point. They have the power, which is acknowledged by everyone, to investigate anything, including federal matters, including things that they may not even have jurisdiction over, let's just say conceptually. But yeah, what happens is, as the sheriff points out, any let's just say findings that they produce, might be problematic with regard to getting them to be implemented.
You know, and I think too that a lot of our success is going to be predicated on the support of the people. And a grand jury, you know, it's established to, you know, support the people and supposed to be a tool to prevent, government oppression. And I think that the grand jury could be used as a tool because I think federal and state organizations fear this type of scrutiny. And a grand jury does have a lot of influence. For example, you know, they could grant indictments. So we are going to take a murder case before the grand jury pretty soon here. So, I think we can put pressure on them. One of the things that we dealt with, when we dealt with NOAA, when these National Marine Fisheries Service, these Office of Law Enforcement agents, well, one agent traveled 150 miles inland from the coast to Siskiyou County to investigate a so-called crime against a rancher because some coho salmon fingerlings allegedly died in a creek on this rancher's property. And when I found out about this, you know, we challenged NOAA. I called them up and said, what are you doing over here? And we have the right to challenge. A sheriff has a right, and I think a grand jury has a right to do this, challenge a government entity's authority for enforcing the law in their county. And I said, what is your authority? Well, we have the authority to enforce the provisions of the Endangered Species Act. I said, well, let me get this straight. You're primarily an entity of the Marine Fisheries Service, working primarily coastal, issues with fisheries. Do you think it's reasonable? And do you think it's proportional? And do you think it passes a straight face test for you guys to drive 150 miles to rouse a rancher in Siskiyou County? And oh, by the way, do you think it might have been a good idea to notify the sheriff, the chief law enforcement officer in the county that you're even over here? Did you ever think that maybe there are officer or agent safety implications involved? Do you think that maybe they're also protocol and respect for the local sheriff? And, oh, by the way, I'd like to know why you're prosecuting one of my local citizens for a federal offense when a California Fish and Game agent was standing right next to you. Why didn't that state official more appropriately handle this violation of law? And, oh, by the way, do you think it's right or constitutional? And I question the constitutionality of you submitting this citizen to federal prosecution in a court that is 250 miles away from that where that rancher lives.
They're trying to do it in San Francisco?
Sacramento.
Sacramento?
It was a Scott Valley case. So, I can see some application where, at least the grand jury and certainly the sheriff and our prosecutor, I said, what you're doing is you're circumventing the federal. And this is what I saw this as. This is a potential abuse of federal police power because what you're doing is you're circumventing the sheriff, you're circumventing the district attorney, the grand jury, and the local courts, and going federal on this. And is that reasonable? I don't think it's reasonable. Is it constitutional? And is it fair and form of judicial restraint or punishment to expect a rancher or farmer to drive 250 miles one way just to appear in a federal court for this alleged violation?
Yeah.
So
yeah, that's remarkable that you.
Yeah.
That's great. Well, the question I come back to though is, what role can we do with the grand jury in plaintiffs? Because it seems to me that with your support and that of Kirk Andrus, your district attorney, that you could, in fact, have a real grand jury according to its constitutional purpose. It sounds like what I was hearing from Roger was that it's kind of drifted away from its constitutional thing, and I guess if a district attorney, wants it to be drifted away, they can seize power and make it happen that way. But it also sounds to me that if a DA and a sheriff are constitutional, you could actually have a real constitutional grand jury here.
Yeah, I think the potential is there, I guess you can also use a grand jury for if these offenses are charged by, let's say, the California Department of Fish and Game charges an offense, let's say a fish kill, in conjunction with this, the incidental take permits or the 1600 or 1602 provisions of the Fish and Game Code. And theoretically, maybe the DA can say, "Hey, look, let's take it before the grand jury. Let's see if and that's one of the things the grand jury, the great function of the grand jury is, they're basically your peers, and a lot of the procedures that have to be followed in a court of law are not followed. It's basically the preponderance of the evidence, and some of the exclusionary rules don't apply, and they could be charged, go in there and be heard." By your peers. If they say, hey, we're not going to issue an indictment on this. This is bogus.
There's a great power to start making these federal agents individually and personally accountable for their actions. And, even without indicting them or go after them criminally, you can subpoena them and start, use the power of the subpoena and have them appear and give testimony or whatever else. Where does your authority derive from? Who told you to do this? Where did you get the power to do this stuff? Show me. I mean, it seems to me that in conjunction with what you're doing as sheriff, having a citizens group actively involved running in a constitutional manner, if doing nothing other than to start to use its subpoena powers, would be a real adjunct to it.
Yeah, I can see some potential there, and you know, the thing is, the grand jury is, you know, the they can issue subpoenas, and they can also you can also face you know, censor, and you know, you can censor not only censor, but also there could be criminal you know, liabilities imposed for not showing up for a grand jury. And generally speaking, I think the federal and state agencies want to comply with the law, and they get some kind of subpoena. They may have their legal staff intervene and try to you know, get the subpoena pulled or something like that, but I can see some real potential where we could use a grand jury to great advantage.
If you call for a grand jury, can you be represented by counsel?
Pardon me?
Can a witness be represented by counsel?
No, that's, well, I don't know. Actually,
generally,
no.
No.
I mean, even,
no.
Yeah, in our, yeah, and that's one of the good things about a grand jury is the.
Yeah, you basically subpoena, you say, hey, look, you know, you're not necessarily charging him. You say, I want to question you. I want the
right.
citizens of this Siskiyou County to question your authority and your decision making. You, John Doe, who came over here and pulled a gun, pulled a badge, closed the road, you know, all the things that they're doing, and put them on the spot. And they can't have legal counsel there coaching them or answering for them. They are there as a witness to give testimony.
Well, they
gentlemen,
can.
We've got about 4 minutes left, and I'd like to throw something out. And Roger, you can correct me. I've been doing a little bit of research on the grand juries in California. And one of the things that was you keep referring to a county grand jury. To me, what you're talking about is a civil grand jury. Those juries don't have the right to do indictments, but they also allow volunteers where the criminal grand juries that do the indictments do not allow for volunteers. They pull from a random jury pool. It seems to me that any criminal court under the state law is able, any criminal court judge should be able to call or assemble a grand jury. There shouldn't be necessarily a distinction between a county grand jury, because there should be both types of grand juries in each county if a criminal judge within that county chooses to assemble a grand jury. The civil grand jury, which is an oversight jury, according to the writings that I've seen of Bruce Olson, who seems to be the ultimate authority on grand juries in California, what he has said is that most of the people that get called or volunteer for this civil grand jury, which I believe is the one you're referring to as a county jury, they don't really understand what their power is as a grand jury member. And they have a lot more powers than they think they do, and they end up just taking the instructions of whatever they're given, and sometimes they see it as a kind of a civic lesson for themselves instead of having a real understanding of what their powers and authorities are. Roger, would you disagree with that?
No, I would agree with that. Now, keep in mind that my level of knowledge with regard to various states is limited. A lot of jurisdictions have different little quirks with regard to their grand jury practice.
That's going on with that and within that county should be under the purview of either, whether it's a civil grand jury or a criminal grand jury. Now, here's the thing. Red has brought up this issue, and we only have a couple of minutes left, but I think this is important. You mentioned about the subpoena power, John, and the subpoena power is really unlimited as long as it's related to something within that jurisdiction for a grand jury. And it could be tremendously intimidating, even for a civil grand jury, to subpoena those officials and make them come in and answer their questions based on their investigation of what they think is being properly or lawfully done within that jurisdiction. I think that could be a powerful tool just if for nothing more than to have them subpoenaed to have to come and testify before the citizens of that county.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. We hold officials accountable, and even if there aren't any apparent, you know, criminal sanctions, usually they don't like that kind of scrutiny, and they don't like any kind of publicity either. So, yeah, I think that's an effective tool, and you're absolutely right. We got to hold them accountable, and also it's very effective them knowing that you're paying attention and that you're looking into these things, because sometimes we understand their plans and policies better than they do.
We're about out of time, but John, I just want to recognize that if the civil grand jury will allow for volunteers, you could persuade some people to go and volunteer for a civil grand jury.
And educate them.
Yep, yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
And what I understood was that the findings actually used to be published in the newspaper. That was what Gail told me, and I think that Terry found a published report for an annual civil grand jury in Siskiyou County for the year 2005-2006.
Right. Yeah, I also do the annual report, which is a public record.
Gentlemen, we're out of time. Sheriff Lopey, I want to have you back. I'm sorry we ran out of time. I think there's a lot more to talk about. I'd really like to track down that Bruce Olson. So, Sheriff, if you can get that information and give it to Kirk so that we can talk to him, I'd love to get some more information from him. He's in Modesto, by the way. Dr. Roots, thank you very much for coming and spending your time with us this evening. Kirk, thank you very much. Red, great show. See everyone next week.
Thank you. My pleasure. Merry Christmas.
Thank you. Merry Christmas.
Okay.
Thank you.
Bye. You're welcome. Bye. Maybe a rock and roll addict dancing on the stage. Money, drugs at your command. Women in a cage. You may be a businessman or some high degree thief. They may call you doctor, or they may call you chief. But you're gonna have to serve somebody. Yes, you are. You're gonna have to serve somebody. Well, it may be the devil or it may be the Lord, but you're gonna have to serve somebody. Serve somebody. You may be a state trooper, it might be a young Turk, maybe the head of some bigger TV network. You may be rich or poor, you may be blind or lame, maybe living in another country under another name, but you're gonna have to serve somebody. Yes, you are. You're gonna have to serve somebody. Well, it may be the devil, or it may be the Lord, but you're gonna have to serve somebody. Maybe you're a construction worker working on a home. Might be living in a mansion. You might live in a dome. You may own guns and you may even own tanks. You may be somebody's landlord. You may even own banks. But you're gonna have to sell somebody. Yeah, you're gonna have to sell somebody. Well, it may be the devil or it may be the Lord, but you're gonna have to sell somebody. Pride. Maybe a city councilman taking bribes on the side. Maybe working in a barber shop, you may know how to cut hair. It may be somebody's mistress, maybe somebody's heir. But you're gonna have to serve somebody. Yes, you're gonna have to serve somebody. Serve somebody. Well, it may be the devil. Maybe the Lord, but you're gonna have to serve somebody. Might like to wear cotton, might like to wear silk, might like to drink whiskey, might like to drink milk, might like to
but you're gonna have to serve somebody.